Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? How's it?
Yo, how's it going?
It's so good to see you, P-Dog.
Yeah, it's been a while, man. Sorry, I've been in and out these days, but I'm back. I'm here.
You're here, and yes. You're here for the most important episode.
Of course.
Well, one of the most important. This is the last episode of the year.
Yes.
So thank you, everyone, for wandering in every week. We see you. We see your presence in the metrics, and we love and appreciate you. We hope that you are able to start unwinding. We need that now, especially yes. If you live in Joburg.
Yeah.
And every day is a Sunday here in the city, which is glorious.
Yeah.
And so we've had the most incredible year. I've got a Perrin here with me. Perrin, you are a multi-hyphenate, is that the word?
Yes.
You're a writer and a shooter and a cameraman.
Yeah,
and
a bit director, of everything.
A little bit of everything. And my name is Russell, and I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. We've got a Cole somewhere. I think he's scurrying around in the back.
Yeah.
But today is a guest episode. So we have our good friend Brett de Groot popping in. Brett has come to the video store before. So deep in the archives is the last time Brett visited. But we wanted him back because Brett is the star of The Magic Box, mm-hmm. which is a new, exciting, fresh Disney production, an official Disney product.
Yes.
That is at the Teatro in Monte Cassino.
Yeah.
It did do some time in Cape Town, but now it's still on. When this episode's out, it's still on during the holiday season. Mm. And we wanted to chat to him because we're proud of him.
Yeah.
He's a good friend. He's Cole's friend. Him and Cole do a lot of productions together. But I've taken great joy in getting to know Brett.
Yes.
From coming to watch a lot of the productions. So for those who haven't got their tickets yet and you're looking for something to do in Joburg, The Magic Box is on, as I said. So if you go to DisneyTheMagicBox.com, you can get your tickets. And then every year we do our most rented episode. Those are typically ones we do at the end of the year. We've changed it up this year. At the start of next year, we are going to put out our most rented episode. That is going to be us talking about the best films of the year. P-Dog, have you started making that list?
Yeah, so normally my annual list comes out like around March because then I've caught up on everything that I need to watch that qualifies for my for my year list.
You put out a list in March about the previous year.
Yeah. So it's usually around March because then I've watched everything that part of my criteria.
I got you. But what are we going to ask of you is in early Jan, we're going to get together and our first episode of 2025 will be our most rented. That's what we call it.
Yeah.
Which is all of our favorite films or TV shows of 2024.
Yeah. So I will give you the stuff that will most likely be my top.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think Brett's going to pop in any minute, but after the chat, myself and Perrin, we're going to have ourselves a little chat.
Yes.
So after the chat with Brett, you and I will chat a bit more because we want to do a little bit of a Christmas thing.
Yeah, you know, it's Christmas joy. We got to get people into the holiday spirit. You know?
Yes, and for those who know, whenever Perrin does do a shift here at the video store, we try our best to have him present a list. Yeah, P-Dog's list.
Twists my arm. Fucking
but you love doing lists, man.
No, I love
it's
lists.
Like literally
lists are
great. It's literally what you do. So yeah. So what do you what is your list?
Okay, it's obviously like holiday Christmas movies. You know, like it's such a good staple of December. Even though people who aren't quote unquote Christians, they love the Christmas movies.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
It's a vibe.
Yeah, there's obviously two genres of Christmas movies. There's the cheesy awful Hallmark type movies,
yeah,
but I'm not an expert in that, so I'm going to recommend Christmas movies that you may have missed or yes. that are still great and you may know about, but I'm just reminding you that they exist.
Cool. Because, yeah, a lot of your lists are the more hidden gem
yes. yeah.
type films, which I love.
Yeah, yeah.
So please stick around for after the chat with Brett, where myself and Perrin will talk about that. All right. I think Brett's going to be here any minute. P-Dog, you got something to keep you busy in the meantime?
Yeah, I'm going to set up our Christmas display.
So okay, I'll in the shop window.
Yes, I'll be painstakingly making that perfect for you.
Okay, cool. Let's do this. Cole! Brett's coming. All right, let's do this. This is Brett popping in to rent something. How's it?
Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's so lovely to have you back.
I know. I was just walking past the video store and I thought I'd pop in.
Bless you.
We are so grateful to see you again.
Thank God. We were so bored right now. We were just talking about Russell's weekend and yeah. I was dying of boredom.
Yeah, I heard it from outside the store what? And that's why I came in. I was just like, let me save this conversation.
I have interesting weekends.
You do have interesting weekends, to be fair.
You are so busy and I want to hear all about it. Yeah. You are on the Magic Box.
Indeed.
You are performing daily
yeah.
over at Monte Cassino.
Yes.
So I want to get into the Magic Box. I want to hear about everything and how it's all come together. I see you wearing a very cool Mickey Mouse top.
Yeah, I mean, what is so great, spoiler alert to everyone listening, I play Mickey Mouse, is I have built-in merch and I've never played a character that has built-in merch. Like anywhere you go now, there's Mickey Mouse stuff and I'm just like, yeah, it's for me.
It's for you.
It's definitely not. Like, but yeah, it's just been a wild ride, really. But yes, I'm currently playing Mickey Mouse in the Magic Box, which is on at Monte Cassino, was at Artscape, and will be touring internationally.
Okay.
It's insane. I mean, it's an
official yeah. Disney
yes.
production.
So this is through Disney Theatrical, who create all the Broadway productions of Disney, like Frozen on Broadway, Lion King, The Little Mermaid on Broadway, Aladdin on Broadway, Hercules on Broadway. So
oh, it makes those sense that it's like an entire division.
Yeah,
right?
It's their own division of, it's like their Broadway division, basically, of
yes.
Well, do
Disney.
You know that the most profitable piece of art in history, so when you think of what? Music, albums, games, is the Lion King musical?
No ways.
Yeah, it's because it's been running for so long.
It's because it continues to make money.
And it continues what? To make money,
because
yeah.
if you think about...
When did that come out?
It's just, like it's early 90s.
Why do I want to say it was 20 years ago? I might be wrong.
Because that's yeah. 2004.
Mm.
Because if you think about, like, you know, that Lion King live action, it made a $1 billion, but that was in like a month. And
yeah,
then, of
right.
course, it peters out.
Yeah.
Where the musicals make so much money.
And remember, it's on Broadway and on the West End.
It can be in many places.
So you're basically getting like, and it's sold out every night.
Yeah,
it's
always full.
You're getting like 3,000 people per night, 8 times a week. That's insane.
At many, many thousands of dollars.
They make so much money. Yeah. They make so much money.
So it's amazing.
How has it been?
It's been incredible. Honestly, I didn't think that I would ever be working for Disney Theatrical. I don't know why. It just seems like quite an unattainable thing.
I mean, like, this is also, I feel like I was explaining this to my boyfriend when we watched the musical. I was like, this is a very, like, poetic and natural progression of Brett's life. One, you played Noddy when you were a child. So you were, like, involved in pantomime from, like, a very young age.
Yeah.
And entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, kids first entertainment, right?
Yeah.
Then secondly, you've had your own original Disney musical, Jukebox
yeah.
musical.
Yeah.
Right? And those two things together equals playing Mickey Mouse in a Disney musical.
Yeah, and it is quite a weird sort of through path, because I think a massive part of my career as well is my first introduction to musicals was through Disney. Like, obviously my parents took me to theater as a kid, but my first physical thing or memory of like a musical is watching The Little Mermaid and being like, oh, I want to do this. Like, it's this elevated
part
story
of that world.
Literally, it's like it's elevated storytelling, you know, because like the musical form works so well in those Renaissance Disney films.
Mm.
And like it really stuck with me. And another really weird tidbit is I was one of the weird kids who was obsessed with Fantasia. And I know Fantasia is not everyone's cup of tea because there's no storyline.
Yeah.
It's like weird and it's all visual.
I found
visual.
It a bit trippy.
It is very trippy, and Magic Box is also quite trippy.
Are we talking about
trippy.
The original Fantasia or 2000?
No, the original Fantasia.
Oh, hectic. I've never seen it.
And
but the broomsticks that come yeah. alive? No, that freaked me out as a kid.
And so I was obsessed with that broomstick scene. And oh, now okay. I get to do that broomstick scene 8 times a week. And it's like, it's so cool. Yeah. I was just like, if 4-year-old me knew that this was going to be like my job, like how weird.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that. Yeah. I love thinking about the sort of 16-year-old yeah. Russell and how chuffed he would be that I so have a yeah. film podcast and yeah. I haven't paid for a movie ticket in 2 years.
That's crazy.
But it's
perks.
It's lovely. And so apart from actually being a performer and being on stage like you are in the Magic Box, you have put up your hand to put on productions.
Yeah.
And that's something Cole, as a musician, has been involved in, yeah. in doing. And you've put on these like really fun, really great productions.
Yeah.
It's called The Big Production.
The Big Productions, yeah.
The Big Productions. And as you said, they tend to be these jukebox musicals. So there was one that was a celebration of Broadway.
Yeah.
Then there was the really great Elton John one. And yeah. then there was the Disney one.
Yeah.
And so I've taken great joy in coming to watch you guys.
Yeah.
Obviously, I originally came to watch Cole, but then yeah. I got to know you.
Thanks, babe.
Yeah.
And it was so lovely to meet you.
Yeah, he traded you in for me. Yeah. Sorry.
Sorry, dude.
And it was just, I could just see, and there was the one Broadway show that you did, which was just a celebration of all the best songs of Broadway. You did a special one that was kind of in and around COVID, where yeah. we were outside on yes. on like the stairs of the National School of Arts yeah. field, and it was just such a welcome thing in COVID. Where
yeah.
I was like, I want to be out. I want to see shows. It just came at the right time.
Yeah, I think
because that point it had been like a year and a bit.
Yeah,
right?
Since there was like any entertainment. And Jesus. Actually, what's quite weird is before I did that outdoor version of Simply Broadway, I had done. Disney in the Park, which was an outdoor version of The Man and the Mouse, which is my Disney show. Yeah. And they sort of approached me and they said, look, we want something that's family entertainment. And I was like, oh, I don't really do family entertainment, but we can try and do something I don't do kids entertainment. I do family entertainment. So we can make this work.
Right.
And that's how sort of the outdoor theater thing started with that. And that's when we saw how people sort of just loved the experience of theater still.
It is important.
I think it's also, you realize like, you know, there's a saying that you need to touch grass. I think it's like, you need to touch chiffon every now and then. You need something like, you need to have like a little bit of art.
What's the expression with grass?
You need to touch grass.
So okay. if you need a reality check because yeah. you're too much in Reddit forums.
Yeah, you need to touch grass, you know, and like okay. be humbled by nature.
Like if you're stressing too much about QAnon, you need to just go yeah. outside and touch some grass.
Totally. I've never heard that expression.
Yeah.
Totally.
You need to touch chiffon.
Yeah. So I would say you need to touch chiffon.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's crazy. Like I think for me, the whole trajectory of this whole thing has been so amazing. When I was auditioning for Magic Box, I had no idea what I was auditioning for. It's a brand new show. They'd done a taste run in Buenos Aires, but there was no information available to us in the audition process of what the show even was. And
sure, so you were just like, it was an open audition in terms of characters.
We were told there's Disney Theatrical is auditioning for this like show that's going to feature all of Disney, which is basically what Magic Box is. It's a compendium of almost all the music from Disney.
All of it.
But it's done in a way that it's very different to what I did with Man and the Mouse. It's much more of a sensory experience. It's there to trigger like memories, and it's like a lot of medleys and that kind of thing. But we didn't know that. And
you didn't know who the characters were going to
no.
be?
No. And we went in, and it was the most grueling audition process I've ever been through in my whole life ever. Like,
okay, in what way?
We had to literally do everything. I've never done an audition where I've had to harness each and every single one of my skills. Like, we first had to dance, then sing, then tap. Then I was called back the next day to sing and dance and tap again in a callback sort of session. And then I was taken aside and they said to me, we know you can sing and dance, but we want you to come back for something else. And I was like, well, I've been cut. This is...
Yeah, what does that mean? It's like yeah. singing and dancing is the other thing. What's the thing that yeah. doesn't feature those
and
two
things?
And
I was things? Like, I've definitely been cut because that's my vocation. So like, right. what am I in for? Am I going to be part of backstage crew?
You're going to be like Tim Curry in that Rocky Horror yeah. production where he's in a wheelchair speaking.
Yeah. So
that's what they're going to make you do.
I came back the next day and it was all very hush hush and they brought us inside.
But sorry, surely them saying you need to come back, I mean, that means you're not cut. But what makes you think you were cut if they were like,
they say
we
you're
need
not
you
going
to
sing
back.
And dance in a musical.
In a musical.
So what does that mean?
You're kind of like, what
it's
am
like,
I going to
do? I'll talk to you
do?
About future project something. Yeah. Or, you know?
Okay. So when I came back the next day, they brought us inside sort of the audition space. And I was shown this picture. It was like a diagram of this puppet of Mickey Mouse. And they were like, we want you guys to audition for the leads of the show, which are... The main Disney Five, essentially, which is Mickey, Minnie, Goofy, Donald, and Daisy. And they lead the show, but they don't speak. And I'm like, what? What do you mean? They're like, it's just puppeteering and you don't speak. And I was like, number one, I've never puppeteered in my life before. Number two, I've never kept quiet for more than like a minute in my whole life. And I was just like, this is crazy because I don't know if I can do this. And yeah, it was quite a weird audition process because even in that, did they test puppeteering once? No.
What?
They tested only our capability to improvise. So I had to do like stand-up comedy, improv, clowning, improv mime, improv. I like had our conversations with them. It was crazy because we first auditioned for Showtime Management, which is the South African producer.
Mm.
And then there was about 50 of us. No, I'm talking rubbish. There was maybe about 30 people called that day for the characters. And then we'll call back 2 months later to audition for the Disney theatrical panel, which are, you know, it features a Broadway director and Broadway producer. So it's like the biggest audition of your whole life. And you're going in and it's all improv. Like,
yeah,
sweet.
It's nightmare fuel. Like,
yeah, it is.
You, like anything can happen.
What are you talking about? I just have to be myself. Yeah. I don't want to do that.
And I walked into this audition. I was the first person to audition on the day for the panel. And I walked in and I remember I met the director Thaddeus and I just walked in. I thought, this guy looks exactly like Walt Disney because he dresses like him. He's got the mustache. He's got everything. And I knew he was a Broadway director and my palms are sweaty, mom's spaghetti, that whole thing. But like, I walked in and the first thing he said to me was, so what is the magic box? And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know, you the director, like. And I realized he wasn't asking me, like, what is the show about? He's saying, like, what is it? And I was like, well, from what I've seen from the concept art is that you want to go for, like, almost German impressionistic theater, soundstage style theater. And I said, it's basically going to be like Fantasia on stage, where it's sensory, not storyline-based.
Yeah, it's not plot.
And I honestly think that's what got me cast, because I understood the concept.
Yeah. Right. You're on the same radio station, at least. But, you're on the same frequency.
But I honestly thought that I was going to play Donald Duck because I was like, they kept on calling me for Donald and I had to keep doing Donald-esque things. Like you, because the whole thing is, you as the puppeteer in the show now, at the end result, have to be the human version of your character.
Yeah, so I think, so just to explain that you're going to hold rods.
So basically, Mickey's attached to a harness in front of me. So he's on a gyroscope attached to my shoulders and to my feet. And then I control his hands and his head. And then his head is also attached to my head via cable. So if I turn my head to the right, his head turns to the right, et cetera, et cetera.
But, you know, but in the show now, you're not going to sing. You're not going to talk.
No.
So how do they do the is
entire
pre-recorded?
No, there is no talking in the whole show. It's only music.
Oh, God.
And it's only singing. And basically, it's like a Greek chorus style piece of theater where the ensemble leads the two main characters, which is Mickey and Mara, who is this audience member who falls into the magic box through sort of this experience where it's quite an interesting... You know, the way that they explained it to us is this is the story of the creation of Mickey Mouse and how he grows up into becoming the Mickey that everyone knows and loves, which is this heroic character. But if people remember correctly, Mickey didn't start that way. Mickey was fashioned off Charlie Chaplin. And so he's a bit of an anti-hero in that he does everything wrong but gets it right.
Right.
Whereas Donald Duck does everything right but gets it wrong. that's the antithesis of the two characters. And
okay, I never thought of them that way.
And so Mickey just, he creates more and more mayhem in this magic box for Mara, who gets sucked in. She doesn't know where the hell she is. And her shadow splits and she has to face both her younger self and her older self and rediscover her inner child whilst Mickey learns to grow up. So it's like, it's a contrasting.
This is a bold
journey.
Swing.
It's like,
it's a very bold
it's
swing.
Interesting hearing and that explanation after seeing it.
Yeah.
Because I think I'd love to watch it again, A, knowing what it is.
Yeah.
Because I think as an ignorant audience member, you go into the teatro, or as Luca would say, teatro.
Yeah.
This was the Peter Turin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Peter Turin Teatro. There's the Peter Turin Theatre, the small one.
Okay.
And then there's the big, big wee one.
Yeah. Is all of it considered the Teatro?
No, the Teatro
the Teatro is just the big one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry, listeners. We're just educating Russell.
So, yeah, exactly. No, but exactly. But why are you saying you go into the Teatro? Because you're performing at Peter Turin.
No,
he's performing
in
Teatro.
Yeah.
Is it at the Teatro?
Yeah, yeah. It's in the big one.
Okay.
So you walk into the Teatro and you think that you're going to get a musical with the plot with characters that speak and then sing. And
yeah.
Speak and then sing. Like, this is like a routine that we're in as South African theatre yeah. goers, right? And then all of a sudden you get that experience where it's all metaphor-based, it's all visual.
Yeah.
And it's also like a fringy form of theatre that we haven't seen before on the stage.
Completely. This is like, think of Cirque du Soleil done through Disney. Like, that's really what
that
this feels
cool.
feels like to me. Honestly, if you're listening and you're like, oh, that sounds too meta for me, trust me, it's not. Like, you...
It's just a vibe.
Irrespective of your relationship with Disney, you're going to enjoy the show because it's...
Absolutely.
It's so well designed in a way that nothing is on the nose. And I think that's actually what makes it good. If we did have Cinderella coming out, if we had the Seven Dwarves coming out, if we had Anna and Elsa, like, it wouldn't be cool. What makes it cool is you're focusing on these five core characters, which are quintessential Disney, and it gives it a very 1940s feel and really grounds the show in something that is actually far more emotional. Like, I think something that really stands out to me, a spoiler alert to everyone, but at the end of the show where Mickey says goodbye to Mara, people get really emotional about it because it's this very intense moment of you have to grow up and you have to leave that
yeah
behind.
Leaving the magic box was hectic at the end. I was like, ooh, This is pulling on a heartstring.
But that is what it is. You know, that is what the show aims to really achieve through the whole process. And when I got cast as Mickey, like, I just felt this overwhelming sense of responsibility because in my final callback, they asked me, they said, okay, you're going to be representing Mickey in this audition. And I just thought, what the hell can I do with Mickey? Like, Mickey is a Boy Scout. Like, he's not three-dimensional in any way. And then I like remembered, like, of course, I know the history of Mickey Mouse, and he actually was a little shit. That's what he was. If you watch any of the original cartoons, he literally causes mayhem in every single one and doesn't care about anything, you know?
Right.
And that's what I did in that last audition, and I think that really helped me along, and I really brought that in. And what was cool is when I got to the rehearsal phase, you know, there's that famous conversation between Tim Burton and Johnny Depp where they discussed the Mad Hatter and they both drew the Mad Hatter.
Right.
The same kind of thing happened where I walked into the rehearsal space and I had the conversation with Thaddeus, who is the director, who I got on so well with. I think I looked up into him in so many ways because I'm a director. I'm also a writer. So, like, I'm also a set designer. So in so many ways, we were, like, the same kind of person. And in the first conversation we had with Mickey was the first time he saw me in the puppet because they kept me separate with the puppet. And then I came in to show them what I'd like sort of figured out. And the first thing I did for them was Mickey discovering his body. And literally the way I did it, like, Thaddeus just burst into tears. And he was just like, you don't understand. Like, 3 years ago when I sat pitching this idea on Broadway and the theater for The Lion King to the Disney exec saying, this is how I want Mickey Mouse. And then for me to come in and do it without his direction, he was just like,
wow,
it's such a weird
It's like,
thing.
Yeah, it's a connection to have that you didn't expect.
No, and not at all. And it was very cool that I'm so grateful that they left me to do Mickey in that way. Cool. He's not at all corporate Mickey at all, which is
It sounds like you understand the true nature of him.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because I never would have looked at Mickey and gone, oh, he's a little shit.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting insight as an actor and as a puppeteer.
Yeah.
Because through your motions and the way that puppet works,
yeah,
you have to embody an animated character, but you're not the animated character. You are the character. It's like this separation, yeah. But it isn't kind of this.
But you're not in like black clothes.
No.
I'm literally
dressed as Walt Disney because I play Walt and Mickey essentially in the show. And where they got this idea from is this really famous photo of Walt Disney leaning against a wall. And his shadow, where his shadow should be, is Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. Right.
And they were like, that's how we're going to do it. We're going to create the puppets that the animators who created them are their
puppeteers.
And so my costume is actually designed directly. And that's how the concept of the whole show actually came about, was from this one photo. So everyone's costumes then were locked into the time period of that photo of these like 1940s, 1930s animators.
Okay.
And that's essentially what the Magic Box is a giant animation studio whereby the animators play all the different characters, which are the ensemble, and they like take on all these roles. So it's very cool. This is like the highest level form of puppeteering, which is really extreme to take on.
Have you had any experience puppeteering?
No, not at all.
Because I don't think anyone grows up and goes like, I also want to add puppeteering.
Yeah, but also it's not like a normal puppet, right? It's a heavy puppet.
It's extremely heavy. It's 70 kilos that I run around with.
Fuck.
And the first thing that I do in the show is run. So,
are you carrying the 70 kilos weight?
Yeah, on my shoulders.
None of it's like...
On my feet.
Oh my God.
So he's basically attached in front of me. Yeah, and it's...
Is the feet of the puppet on your feet?
The feet of the puppet is attached to a rod, which is connected with my shoes. So,
okay,
he's about 20 centimeters in front of me,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
I've seen pictures, but I haven't quite figured out exactly how...
So he's like a fully realized character by himself. Okay. You know, it's quite interesting. It's like... The whole concept. So the producer of Magic Box is Felipe Gamba, who's also the producer of Lion King on Broadway. So obviously a very successful person.
Yeah, as we said, callback at the beginning. This is a producer of the most profitable piece of art in history.
And,
yes.
And if you meet this guy, you'll be like, what? Like, because he's so relaxed and chilled and like friendly and lovable and like gets emotional in rehearsals when we're doing something that he thinks is beautiful. And like, he is a dream producer. He really is. I must say, every single person we worked with from Disney is exactly the kind of person you would expect to work for Disney.
They believe
in the magic.
Okay. And these are folks that have come out from overseas. Yeah. So like the director's name, what was his name?
Thaddeus. So Thaddeus McWillie.
That's such a cool name.
Amazing. And he
heritage? Thaddeus.
He's American. I think it's Jewish. Thaddeus is Jewish normally.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. And he used to come to rehearsals every day on a skateboard in a full 3-piece suit with a fedora and a pipe.
What?
And badass.
And he's like nearing 60.
Oh, cool.
He's just so cool.
Like, and
have they moved on now that you've started?
Yeah,
because
once your show opens, then obviously your production team leaves, and then you have resident directors and choreographers that stay on. So you have your dance captain who keeps the dancing clean, and then you've got your resident director who keeps the show in tune.
I've always found that very interesting because it's testament to how theater is the actor's form.
Oh yeah.
Because your director will do all the directing in the build up, but then usually once the show starts, the director kind of sort of signs off.
I mean, like, even before then, there's the opening night that they stay for, right? So do they see the first production and do they talk to you afterwards?
Oh, yeah, that's what you have previews for. So the first week of the show is previews and then you have opening. That's our opening's never the first night of your... The show is available to the audience. That's not your opening night. Opening night is the first Sunday of the week that you open.
Mm.
And every performance prior to that is called a preview. And that is where... many things can still change. So if you come to a Wednesday preview and then come to the Thursday preview, some things may have changed because the directors are watching.
If
and
those
they're
laughs
be like,
don't land or if that...
Yeah, and they'll be like, no, I think we're going to cut that scene. We're going to move that. We're going to take this song away. Like these things.
Because you're gauging the energy of the play in a room full of people.
Yeah, so that's how it works. And it's interesting because this musical was very workshopped, which is very different to what I think a lot of South African performers are used to coming and getting blueprint musicals, and they just have to, okay, you go stand on 8, you go stand on 7, you go stand on whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, your stage is numbered, and that you do the exact choreography. Whereas this is all workshopped. We were left to our own, not to our own devices, but especially the characters. We were not directed. We were told, like, here are 3 wheels of cheese. You need to steal the cheese. How are you going to do that?
Wild.
And then you go and develop it and whatever, which for me, that's the dream. That's where I come from. All of my stuff has been workshopped. So it's yes. like
do
perfect.
Do you think this is going to be a play that is workshopped wherever it is?
No,
or are you actually helping craft this show?
So we are now the blueprint.
That's incredible that you get to be there.
It's insane. We are the world premiere of this. And as we tour internationally now, we will be the official international cast.
How did this come to South Africa so soon?
So from what I can understand is Hazel Feldman, who owns Showtime Management. She is, honestly, if you want to talk about like boss business ladies, yeah. she is like right up there.
Hazel?
Feldman.
Feldman.
And Hazel, I mean, Hazel basically cut her teeth at Sun City. She was one of the people that brought a lot of the shows into Sun City.
Right.
And now Showtime Management is so big. I mean, they do everything from like monster trucks all the way to like musical theater.
Yeah,
their main focus, obviously, is musical theater. They just brought Tyler here. Like, that's their kind of massive reach.
Oh, dope.
But Hazel...
So they're like moving into the big concert space as
yeah.
well.
They've always been there.
Oh,
yeah.
really?
Okay. Yeah, no, they've always done that. Yeah.
So, but Hazel loves modern musicals. It's really her thing. Is she doesn't look at like the golden age stuff. She really loves anything that's like cutting edge and different.
Because
and
modern musicals become classic musicals.
Totally.
If you've done
and
them
also
right.
Hazel's, I think Hazel's mantra is to surround herself with young ideas and young talent and. Thank heavens, because there's so many other producers in the industry don't want that. They're sort of clinging onto this team of people that...
It's safe to go with the one that you know. Yeah, and also, that guy always delivers.
Yeah, and also like, even their teams that they work with on like the production side, they don't want to swap it out for young, fresh people. And Hazel's the opposite. And basically, I think Hazel and Felipe, who produced Lion King, they had a working relationship because I think Hazel brought Lion King here originally.
Oh. That was what the teatro
was
built
for.
Opened
yeah.
with.
It was built for Lion King.
What?
It was the first one. Yeah.
yeah, that's why the teatro is designed. Like the architecture is very Lion King.
Yeah, okay. It was made.
Interesting.
For
it was made for Lion King.
But it was one of those like, this is the play that is set in Africa. We're in Africa. Yeah. Let's not turn this into a Greek theater.
Yeah.
My favorite moment was getting vomited on by a very cute little girl behind me who was just too excited at the Lion King.
She like vomited from excitement.
Yeah, and I turned around to be like, what the fuck? And there was this cute little girl that was just like, I drank too much slushy. I was like, it's okay, my
girl.
Yeah,
we've all been there.
Like, we've all been there. Even at 20.
Yeah, if I had a nickel.
Yeah. okay, so she obviously knew that.
Yeah.
She had created that relationship as a result.
And she heard that they were test running this musical in Argentina, but obviously it was all in Spanish.
Sure.
And Hazel flew over, went and saw it, and she was like, we can do this. She's like, let South Africans be the ones to embody this. And
there's no... But what's nice, correct me if I'm wrong now. So sorry, obviously you know this play by the back of your hand. Cole, you went and saw it. There's no speaking in between. You said it's just music.
Yeah.
It's just music. So obviously wherever you are in the world, you know those songs, even if you sometimes don't even understand them.
Yeah.
But you know the English songs. So this can be anywhere in the world.
Literally. I think that's the one of the smartest things about it is it is irrespective of like experience, language barrier, religion. It's like this, it's all this is this really compressed sensory experience and memory experience of like your childhood. And it's like they've done like really clever things. Like there are lots of hints to Disney in it throughout, obviously. Like Dumbo's feather makes an appearance and you'll be like, oh, I don't know that feather. Why is that feather so... You know, it's like you're triggered by it. Mickey's blue wizard hat. There's a scene where Mara runs through forests and the forests sort of fold through the various forests of Disney. And it's quite weird because you can identify each and every forest. You're like, that's Hercules, Mulan,
you recognize
that's Bambi,
all the styles.
That's whatever. And the styles are so distinct.
And then also the Bambi silhouettes.
amazing.
Like that image of Bambi's father. Was it Bambi's father in the film?
No, so it's Bambi's silhouette that sort of comes on.
Oh, yeah, but in the play.
Yeah,
you see Bambi's silhouette. It's also like a puppet, right?
Yeah.
But I was thinking in the film, there's that image of a deer with the silhouettes.
Yeah.
That's quite like
exactly,
iconic.
It's very iconic. Yeah. And that song that people have forgotten about, like, it's so beautiful.
So many of those old numbers where you sit there and you go, oh, it's been like 20, 30 years since I heard this.
Yeah.
You know?
In my head, it was in the smaller theater. So has it been in the theater the whole time?
Yes, yeah. And it was an Artscape before that.
What is the performing at the teatro like
for
you?
It's your teatro debut, isn't it?
Yeah, it's my teatro debut. I've never performed at the teatro before. And it is, I mean, it's interesting. Like we were at Artscape prior, which is the very big theater in Cape Town. And you have so much space. And then we come to teatro, and teatro like has zero wing space.
Okay, I was about to say,
so to fit a show this big in there, it's quite insane, but it works. Like, we've got an amazing crew that just know how to, like, it's like Lego. It's like Tetris. But it's amazing. I mean, doing a show like this, I think in front of these massive audiences, sometimes you are so focused on the puppet that you sometimes forget that they are there. I can't explain
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Like, that was the experience I had, is I thought that it was, oh, like you as a performer, sorry.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it from an audience member's perspective. For me, it was like, it was really easy to forget that the puppeteer was there and get lost in the performance of the puppet.
But you're saying it's easy to forget that
the audience is there. Because in this show in particular, what we're finding is the audience is so like overwhelmed that they like don't know how to react to anything until the end, where people just like basically fall apart and cry and clap and whatever.
Yeah.
Because it's such a roller coaster of a show. It does not stop, not for a single second. As before,
there's not even an interval.
No, there's no interval. It's an hour and a half show. And from basically minute one of the show till the end, I don't leave the stage. Neither does Ashley Scott, who plays Mara. So it's extremely intense and physically intense. But like, it's very cool. I think my favorite part of the whole show is right in the beginning, where they do the Mickey reveal, where you see the creation of Mickey Mouse, and hearing people's response to when they reveal me, that is the magic box. Like, people lose their minds when they see Mickey Mouse. And it's such a weird thing, because it's such a visceral, like, people can't help it. There's like fully grown men that are just like, Mickey, like, it's so interesting. Like,
okay.
Yeah. And I've got a very difficult, that opening scene is very difficult, because you're also educating the audience on the vocabulary of the show. Like, there's no talking. This is how the puppets work. It's what Felipe calls the double event, which is you and the puppet are one. So you can watch the puppet or you can watch the puppeteer, and you should be able to withdraw the same context.
Yeah.
Right.
But at the same time, you're also the puppet's conscience, their brain, their emotions. So if the puppet is limited in showing that emotion, you show that emotion. So it's difficult, because this is more so clowning than what it is puppeteering. It's obviously, there's a massive puppeteering aspect to it, but you have to do a lot of clowning and like overperforming to get this sort of across.
Mm-hmm.
And what a cool skill to hone. Because that's the thing, I don't miss the singing actually at all.
I was about to say, can you enjoy that?
I've loved it. I've sung all these songs already. You know what I mean? I've done them in my own context and whatever. And I'm just like, this is so much more rewarding, because it's so much more memorable. And it's so difficult that it's like, I want to be challenged. I want to have the most difficult thing to do in the show. And I most certainly have that.
The 70 freaking kilogram puppets.
Yeah.
I've just seen when you sort of stretched your arm, you have a Mickey tattoo.
I do have a Mickey tattoo that I got when I did. I've got a tattoo of every show that I've written, and that was when I wrote The Man and the Mouse. And it was quite funny, because I walked into the audition for Magic Box, and they were like, did you? And I'm like, no, I'm not psychotic enough to get a tattoo before I even get the role. But they were like, oh, it's built-in branding. And I'm like, sure.
But I was like, but for your consideration.
Yeah, totally.
I've marked my body with character I'm
no
about
pressure,
to
guys,
for.
But this is the lengths I'm willing to go to.
It's interesting talking about the difficulty of the musical, because when you're watching it, like, you get a sense of, I mean, like, the puppets, as part of the illusion, the puppets look light. So afterwards, when you told me that the puppet was 70 kilograms, I was kind of shocked, because the thing that was effortless now seemed like, oh, it was actually a lot of effort. but then also watching the dancers and the company perform, where I was like thinking about, oh, they're managing props, they're managing the set, they're hitting marks, which are like all over the place, and singing in this chorus. I was like, and that's also nonstop for 90 minutes, where I was thinking about the last one I saw was Mamma Mia, where it's like everyone chills in the town, they sit or they sweep, and then they sing, and then they chill for a bit. And I was like, this is incessant.
This is a performing Olympics. Like every, you know, they always say like, oh, there's no small parts. In Mamma Mia, there are small parts.
Totally.
Whereas in Magic Box, every single cast member is important.
Because
the set literally moves because of the cast. The ensemble each have like solos, so it's a marathon.
The one point where I realized like how much had changed, where it, like when you're saying you're overwhelmed at the start of the show, we'd have just like the white box on stage, and then all of a sudden in the next scene it's an office with four drawing desks in it.
Okay.
And just like, where the fuck did those come from?
Yeah, and they appear out of nowhere. Yeah,
and now they're tap dancing on it, and 5 seconds later, those things are gone.
Amazing.
You know?
Are you going to travel with it now? What are the future plans?
So we basically finish up in Joburg on the 5th of Jan. So there's still 4 weeks, 3 weeks left of the show. So book your tickets. There are very limited seats available, but it is definitely worthwhile.
You're just going to take a break on like Christmas Day?
Yeah, so we have Christmas Day off, but the rest of the time we are performing.
It's the time to go out and see
exactly
stuff.
And like I love, everyone's like, oh, aren't you sad to perform over Christmas? Are you kidding? Like what an amazing, every time that I feel tired, I'm like, some kid in this audience
is having the fucking time of their life,
got this ticket for their birthday.
Yes.
And they have been waiting.
Yes.
And you have to deliver like that. Yeah. And to me, that's like amazing. Like you're part of a Disney legacy now. That's an opportunity that you cannot sneer at.
To me, the fact that you are crafting what could hopefully be a future famous Disney show, to me, that is single-handedly the most exciting thing.
And how cool. I get to put that I was the Mickey Mouse on my CV. Like it's so random.
Exactly.
But so we go from Joburg to Abu Dhabi to Doha, and then there is further territories planned that we are not allowed to speak about just yet.
Sure. Okay, but cool. but then if they've got you and they feel like you're a good fit, this could be something that you kind of ride
as long as you're able to. We would tour with it as long as we're able to. The only places we're not allowed to perform is the States and UK because of the union rules. They have to have Americans or British people performing.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
But, I mean, you get a tour of the world literally playing single-handedly the most important character ever created in history. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
That's lovely, man. Okay, speaking of great musicals.
Yes.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on Wicked.
Oh, my God. I hated it. No joking.
Is that what you could return to the video store? Is that something you've watched recently?
There's something else that I'm going to return to the video store because I'd love to hear your guys' opinion on it. But I did see Wicked. I thought it was spectacular. I knew Cynthia Erivo would kill it because obviously I know her history in musical theater, and I think what a smart decision to cast someone who is so vastly different from Idina Menzel. That's what you need to do because Idina Menzel played the Elphaba on Broadway, the original Elphaba, and obviously Idina Menzel's got a really witchy sound. And Cynthia Erivo does not have that sound.
Yes.
And I think it's perfect. I think that is exactly what it is. You need to have someone who can...
There's like a different archetype, right? You have the theatre archetype and then the cinematic archetype,
And even like just to play the Wicked Witch in that way, I think it's so multi-layered and it's great.
I'm so upset about the story. Like the more I think about it and I think about her being melted with water by Dorothy.
Yeah.
I just like, this upsets me so much.
When you think about...
I suppose part two is going to come and I'm going to get like an understanding of where this goes. But it's just,
I was also super impressed with Ariana Grande because Elphaba is a big sing, but Glinda is an acting role. And I remember when I saw it on the West End, I wasn't impressed. Not that I wasn't impressed, but I felt that the Glinda felt flat because it was a British Glinda and she did it in a British accent. And I'm like, Glinda has to be American.
There is an American
accent. She has to be a valley girl. She has to be there's just something so much about a kid cheerleader about her.
Yes.
And I thought Ariana Grande delivered. Like, I was like, this is incredible. Her comedic timing and stuff is so great, and how she does it so subtly, it's fantastic. What I did not like about Wicked, to the choreographer of Wicked, why are we dancing on the 6, 7, and 8 and every half beat in a song? Like, we do not need hand choreography on every single beat of a song. It's
right,
too much.
It's incessant.
It's too much. It's too camp. We're already doing a musical. We don't need to make this any more camp than what it is.
Okay, sorry, break down exactly what you're saying there.
So I just think that, like, sometimes choreographers forget that when you're working on screen versus when you're working on stage, how choreography translates.
Okay.
And last time I was here, I spoke about musicals and musical films. And if you go watch Chicago, for example, the way that it's filmed and choreographed, it sort of molds together very well because it's all elevated in Roxy's mind. But Wicked, the choreography is part of the reality of the characters.
Mm. Right.
And why are we doing hip-hop in a hair salon when you've got the two main characters singing? It's almost like distracting. And yeah.
But you were saying specifically the 7 and the 8.
Oh, it's on every beat of the song. I mean, like, you wouldn't normally do that. You would normally, like, hold a dance move for, like, 2 counts or whatever. But they're literally, like, I mean, I can't show because this is not a visual medium. But
no, sure.
But it's like they're just whacking on every single beat. They're, like, with their hand, their head, the eyebrow. And I'm just like, we need to calm down.
This is, like, okay, a really interesting point for me because I think it might be a stylistic thing, like, from the vision of the director.
Yeah.
Because my issue with the cinematography and the lensing and the lighting, like everything that goes with cinematography, is that it had no focus. Is that it was also just like, okay, we have practical sets, we have 100 dancers, we need to see all of it all the time.
Yes.
And then we're just going to like either like shoulder pan across this thing.
I wanted it to be more cut and put together like a music video. It's so bizarre that we're all going to start singing and dancing.
Yeah.
I think you got to lean into the fantasy of it. Get a little bit more Baz Luhrmann-y. Do you know what I mean? Like, just cut it like a music video. Add extra lighting.
Or make it more operatic. I don't know what it is. Lately, I've been seeing a lot of this, and it's like, even in live theater, I won't mention the production's name, but I just really felt like, why do we have to see everything all the time?
Yes.
Whatever happened to having a single spotlight on a person and having the audience focus on what they are singing and the words they are singing? And like Wicked, you could do the same thing. There's nothing stopping you from like having her in a glade in the woods and having like one beam of light come down and simplify it.
Mm.
You know, that sometimes is way more powerful and really honing on what the actor is doing. But
sometimes it's the same with musical composition where it's like, we don't all have to play something.
It's like,
let's just stop and let just that guy play guitar.
The comparison for me and how motivated it is in terms of stories and West Side Story, I'll never shut up about this. I think it's the best musical
ever
made.
We know, it's fine. We had to support you.
Cool, thank you so
much. This is the Steven Spielberg West Side Story.
I don't know if you guys know, this is the West Side Story podcast.
Is the moments in the gymnasium where you have intentional chaos.
Yes.
Of the Puerto Ricans and the, what do we call them?
The Jets
crowd, right? And your camera is moving through seas of people that are moving horizontally across, like, camera in different directions. They both have intentional color palettes, so they seem part of their groups. But then as soon as we go to, is it Tony?
Yes.
And Maria?
Yeah.
They're behind the bleachers.
And they've got the light coming through.
It floods the scene behind, so you don't see anyone
Precisely.
Else.
Precisely. I really think that, but again, we are speaking about Steven Spielberg, who understands cinema, but 100%. And even in his dance sequences, if you watch like America, for example, the way that you still focus on Anita through all of that.
Yes.
Despite there's some incredible dancing happening, he just knows how to do it.
He tells you where to look.
Yeah.
But I think it takes a lot of confidence to make those creative decisions, to go, everybody stop and it's just that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or, you know, you've got this huge, as you said, beautiful, overwhelmingly built, very fucking expensive set. And now you're going to tell me we're not going to screen
show it.
There's a producer behind your shoulder being like, I spent $50 million dollars on that set. Yeah. Show it.
There are some moments in Wicked that I think work really well. For example, so something that really surprised me was the Jeff Goldblum scene with the wizard where he goes behind the curtain and he's got that sun that he's bouncing around.
Gorgeous.
And I'm like, that's just such old vaudevillian style. That is musical theater. Like, let that be it.
Yes.
Something else that really... surprise. Okay, listen, Cynthia Erivo honestly can reverse over my family and I would thank her. Like, she's just so good in this movie. But like, her versions of the song, I'm like, no one else can sing these songs ever again. Like,
no,
it's impossible. Like, her version of The Wizard and I, honestly, it's insane.
We did that in some
Broadway,
we did, right?
And it's incredible. Like, her version is just, and I just love how that's a hard song to sing. I've sung that song. It's a hard song to sing.
Right.
She is singing it with, like, as if she is yawning in the morning.
There was a clip of her, I think it's on the Jimmy Fallon show. Thank goodness Jimmy Fallon isn't in the clip, because screw Jimmy Fallon. And you see her stand up and do the Alphaba
riff just do it
at the end.
Yeah.
And the effortlessness that you see is kind of just like breathtaking.
She's like a once in a lifetime talent, really. But I think for me, her best scene in the whole movie is when she sings I'm Not That Girl, which is like a song that really isn't rangy. It stays very, you know, between specific notes, but it's so, like, intimate.
Which part of the story was that?
That's when she's in the forest and she realizes that Fiero's in love with Glinda.
Oh, right.
And I was like, that song didn't ever stand out in the musical, but in this movie, it stands out so well.
I know,
well.
I think you're distracting it. The reason why we all relate to it so well is because we're saying, oh, fuck, Jonathan Bailey doesn't love me. And we all, like, understand.
I'm not that girl.
I'm not that girl.
You forget that she's brought the color purple into her performance, because that's what she
100%
had done on Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which is all about being mistreated by the world and downtrodden and persecuted.
Wow.
And so
that's an interesting parallel.
She's very right for the role of someone who's now
she's perfect.
Being outcast.
And I think it's also very clever to have someone like her play that role. It's just, it's brilliant casting.
Mm. So I think we're nitpicking, but for the most part, you loved it.
I loved it.
Yeah,
I see,
this is like cool when something is like so great and it's so close to being perfect. You're going to be more critical of the things that hold it back.
It's one of the best movie musicals that's ever been made.
Absolutely. 100%.
But it's just, there's like, I think because I intrinsically understand musical theater and musical theater film, that I noticed that.
100%,
What was the other thing you wanted to
return? Oh, what I wanted to return is, I don't know if you guys have watched The Penguin.
Oh, yes. I started watching it. Halfway through, I think.
And I want to know, and now I've forgotten her name, which is just so great, because the whole point I wanted to make was about her name. It was about this actress, but the actress who plays the antagonist of The Penguin.
The Hangman.
Yes.
She goes into Arkham as this person that killed a whole bunch of people.
Where has this actress been?
Her name is Kristen Milioti.
Yeah. You guys.
And I have seen her in something else before. Let me like pull up the IMDb.
So she was in How I Met Your Mother, which I think is so random.
She's the mother.
But I'm just like,
oh, she's been in loads of stuff.
She's been in Wolf of Wall Street.
She was his original wife in Wolf of Wall Street. She's the one that pulls the Margot Robbie out of the car, or him out of the car when she catches him snorting coke.
But talk about a role that is going to like transform your career.
Absolutely.
The TV show is brilliant.
TV show is on Showmax.
Yeah, it's on Showmax. Brilliant.
Colin Farrell.
I was about to Colin Firth.
Transforms into the Penguin.
He's incredible. But
she
steals the show.
Every single scene.
The last episode of the season, holy crap, this girl she is like, I don't care about that this is called The Penguin. This should be called The Hangman, because this chick destroys the series. She is incredible.
I've got something that you could potentially rent.
Okay.
It's a movie called Palm Springs. Have you seen it?
No.
Okay. Her and Andy Samberg.
Okay.
In a Groundhog Day-esque concept.
Okay.
So it's the day, it's the morning of a wedding, and the day repeats itself.
Yeah.
And it's their relationship as this kind of day keeps repeating. It's classic Groundhog Day, but it's a bit more Andy Samberg-esque in that's always kind of like a fun ride. But she's the lead.
Interesting.
So that would be a good thing for you to rent.
Yeah, definitely.
Palm Springs. I think it's on Showmax. It was at one point. But she's great in it. I'm trying to think whether she was in anything else. Okay, but that's a good one.
Yeah.
So you're enjoying The Penguin.
I honestly think if anyone wants to see great character acting, the Penguin is it. Like, so brilliant. And what a way to take, like, a comic book-based property and make it into, like, a psychological thriller.
Yeah, well, that was what was so nice. So The Penguin first showed up in The Batman,
yeah,
which was the big movie that had Robert Pattinson as Batman. And everyone walked away from that going, oh, this isn't just like a Batman throwing stars and doing gadgets and doing shit.
No.
Oh, he's an actual detective. He's like looking at evidence,
yeah,
thinking about it, yeah, interrogating. He's like actually not being a superhero. He's just being a detective in a, yeah, really cool outfit.
And I mean, that's
but
really
it grounded the movie.
And this series also really grounds not only the world in which that exists in, but like the Penguin as a character, which is, as a villain, everyone knows Danny DeVito's version. It was an incredible version.
Right.
But this is so nuanced and layered. And I think,
and a
like,
bit more real, right?
What I think is going to be so cool is, like, where do they take the franchise from here? Like,
yeah,
this could actually, you know, be a real contender. Like, Christopher Nolan's films will always be sort of apex. But
yeah,
this could take it further.
Absolutely.
One thing I want to talk about,
yes,
because I want to hear more about it, was the wedding that you had recently. Well, not recently. When was it?
It's like half a year ago.
In May.
Yeah. It's going to be May. Yeah.
Earlier this year, you got married. And for those who don't know, the last time you visited the video store, you told the most incredible story about a wedding that you attended. Because,
yes,
you'd attended lots of weddings.
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you were often in the bridal parties.
Yes.
And weddings seem to be a big part of your life.
Yes.
So much so that you had a host of stories, one of which is this rather grueling but very intense story about a horse, which,
yeah,
I don't want to get into it. There'll be a link to your previous visit so people can hear it. But you got the chance to now host your own wedding.
My own, yeah.
I also did relatively recently.
Yeah, we married each other. I remember that.
I was personally reminded, as much as I did love my day and was very grateful to now be married to the love of my life, attending weddings is a lot more fun than hosting. But it sounded like you had an amazing wedding.
Well, so I have been part of 16 bridal parties.
That's fucking, it's a lot.
That's unprecedented.
I know. If anyone else gets married, I'm literally killing them. They're going to come and tell me, and I'm pulling out a revolver, and that is it.
Why? I don't think I asked this at the time. Why is it that you think you have been included in so many?
Why do you not think I'm worthy of having friends?
No, I mean, I've got lots of friends, but I'm just curious.
Brett's like the life of the party. Brett's the raconteur. He's like the easy laugh, you know?
There we go. It's nice to hear it from someone else.
But I think it's also like, I come with a particular skill set of like,
I have a particular set of skills.
I will find you and I will throw your wedding. It's like, I think because I work in like production, and in that way people know that they can rely on me to like help their wedding along.
They believe that you can add some pizzazz,
yeah. Okay. And it's funny because a lot of the wedding party, I'm sorry if you're listening to this, some of you, but you won't know that it's you. But some of the wedding parties being part of, the bride and groom have been very like vanilla people.
Yes. And so but it's nice that they want some spice.
It's the spice of life. Exactly. Okay. I am.
They've recognized how they're going
to
up the.
I am the Arrakis to their friendship group. But it's like,
I don't know the reference.
Dune.
The planets,
the spice planet.
Wow, so this is a movie podcast.
Sorry, in my head, I didn't go to Arrakis as the planet, sorry.
So it's...
Okay.
I think that's why... I don't know. And I think I just generally have a lot of close friends.
No, but that's amazing.
Yeah, it
I
is
certainly
cool.
don't have 16
I don't
close
know,
friends.
I don't know why they want to be friends with me, but I'm very grateful for their friendship.
I'd like to perhaps get Cole to start. Instead of a bridal shower, you attended a
what
for Brett instead of a bridal shower?
I wasn't part of the bridal party.
No. But instead of attending a Brett, you tell him.
Yeah, so, I don't know what you're talking.
So, we had a bridal shower.
That's what I was looking for. You told me about that,
yeah,
Cole,
we had a bridal
and I was
shower.
Like, I love the fact that it's a bridal shower.
Yeah,
yeah. We had a bachelor's before a few weeks before the wedding, which was thrown by by surprise with us. And that story, I literally cannot tell on this podcast.
Okay. Yeah, that was wild.
It was.
I've heard that story.
But let me but tell you,
so there
if
was
you think the horse story is wild.
Okay, but that horse story was also gruesome and bloody and traumatic.
So is the Bachelor story.
Oh, God. So there was some trauma.
Yeah. There was murder. No, I'm joking. There wasn't.
But this is interesting. That
someone died.
Does one have two separate bachelor parties?
No. We had a joint bachelor's party thrown by a friend, Nicola, who, just for the perspective of who Nicola is as a human being, her literal job is to throw London and Dublin Pride. So she is the gayest person, even though she is a straight woman.
Yeah.
Like, this woman is unhinged. So her level of like extravagance cannot be tamed.
Right.
Okay.
And then apply to
bachelor party.
Yeah. Let's just say my parents are scarred for life because it was thrown at my parents' house. And wow, I've got photos of my mom in the background and her facial expressions. Mint.
Is this sort of hangover level, like the start of the movie where it's like,
honestly,
we fucked up.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. There was obviously drinks involved, but it wasn't like anyone got completely smashed. It wasn't that. It wasn't an alcohol thing. It was. She basically. I'm telling the story half now, but she basically hired a bear bum butler who, if you know what that is, it's basically a guy who comes and serves drinks in an apron, but he's naked behind the apron, so you see his bum.
Sure.
And they just serve drinks. But the person who arrived was not a bare bum butler, nor was it the person that she had found
selected
on the website.
Yeah.
It was something else.
Oh, God. Mm.
And this man, I cannot explain in words, but only in... When he left, he was so lathered in oil that when he left, there were like human outlines on my mom's wall of where he was like trying to like... sexily dance against the wall, and there was nothing sexy about him.
Okay.
But there were so many other things that he did. He was the catalyst. I cannot say this in the podcast because there might be children listening.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was wild. It was wild. I think everyone became extremely sober very fast when he arrived, and we were like, "Wow, this is happening.
This is happening."
But we had a bridal shower at our wedding, which was in a wine cellar.
This was the mistake. It's like.
And Cole nearly missed the wedding the next day, which was great.
Yeah, it was touch and go.
Yeah.
I got out of bed an hour before the wedding.
Well, because...
it was free wine.
Yeah, shit.
It was...
I mean, yeah.
You're reminding me of a story someone told of a woman doing a kind of strip show at a bachelor's that involved oil that she lit.
Yeah.
But she sort of doused the oil in such a way that it kind of went up the dude's pants, and it like like almost set this dude on
fire.
Just
one of the things that this guy did, that this non bear bum butler, this you know, when you order off Shein,
surprise,
and you get number one, the thing to remember is this guy in his picture was like this incredibly tall Adonis, and when he arrived he like maybe took me up to my hip. Like, he was just like this short, weird man. And he had a ponytail on top of his head, like a little palm tree. It was quite weird.
Yeah.
And then one of the things he did is he went to our friend Andrew, who was he's very, very straight. He bent him over the couch, lifted his shirt, and then licked him from the top of his ass cheeks all the way to the nape of his neck, and then whispered in his ear, "Are you okay with this?"
It's like, I've already done
it. It's too late.
Yeah.
It's too
Don't
late.
Don't ask for my consent now.
So, you know, we physically had to chase this guy at the house. He was just having too much of a good time. It was wild. But
crazy.
To your point about throwing your own wedding, I thought it was very cool to do it. I don't know. I think what the one great thing is, because I've been part of so many weddings, I literally went about planning my wedding in that, like, I literally do not want this to be like anything else that we've been to, because it needs to feel organic and like true to the two people that are getting married.
Yeah.
And also because we didn't have to follow any of the traditions, really. We don't have the white dress. We don't have any of those things, which is really cool. You can design it in your own way.
And Cole said your mom's walked each of you down the aisle.
So
did you do that at the same time or one at a time?
So Dan and I walked down the aisle together. To It's Raining Men. Yeah.
That was like the moment as a person in the congregation where you realized, oh, of course, wait, this is Bridesmaiding. It's not going to be like any other wedding where you hear it's raining men and then they come running, holding hands, skipping down the aisle.
It was wild.
Okay.
And I was just like,
we
this
also
is...
didn't have a bridal party. We've got five godchildren, and I swear, if any of my family are listening, if one of you pop out one more child, it's over. I'm leaving the country. But we've got five goddaughters, and they were our like blonde babies, and they came down to man, I feel like a woman. So. And they're also
wearing leather
sassy.
Jackets and black tutus.
Yeah. So
it was adorable.
And then our moms met us at the end of the aisle and they sort of gave us away.
So It's Raining Men sort of took you sort of to the
front. To the front.
To the front, but then you still had to walk down the aisle.
No, we were at the end of the aisle and they met us at the
altar.
The altar, yes.
Yeah, altar.
I was about to say the pulpit.
The moon.
Okay, so sorry. So your moms didn't walk you down there?
No. My mom was crying so hard that she definitely cannot walk anywhere.
Okay.
My mom was a mess.
We were all crying hard.
It's like when my mom was with me when I did Silver Scat and Fierce and we had to walk down the red carpet and I was like, do you want to walk with me? And then you're being interviewed by press and in every single TV interview, it's me talking and this woman sobbing hysterically next to me and I'm just like, get it together.
You're on camera,
come
mom.
On Celeste, like this is we're not going to get this again. Like
it's like a Chad Leclerc's dad at the Olympics where he's like, just look at him. Yeah. Unbelievable. Look at him, my beautiful boy.
That's actually my mom.
Okay, just to understand, what exactly did the moms then do?
They then waited for us in the aisle and then, like in any ceremony where they're like, who gives this person away? Then father of the bride would give the bride away, but our moms gave us away.
Okay.
Yeah. It was just amazing. I am not particularly... It's not to say I'm not an emotional person, but I'm always like, I will laugh in situations to make light of things, to make everyone feel better.
Yeah.
But instead, all I did at my wedding was cry the whole time, which is very unlike me.
Okay.
But just because I
was... What was the bet about Dan crying?
There was no bet because everyone would be just very rich.
Yes.
You're like betting against the sun rising.
Dan's your husband.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Who famously...
Allegedly.
Cries incredibly easily. Right?
Yes.
At my wedding, I thought like, I'm cool. I'm in this. It's like, there was a lot to think about. There was a lot going on. We got married in the bush. So it was like very hot. And in my head, I'm like, why did we decide to do this in such hot sun? And, you know, fuck. And then, the moment she arrived, the moment I had to sort of shake Louis, my father-in-law's hand, I also was just, there was like a button that just pressed and it was just like, cry. I was like, oh, fuck.
I think for me, it was like, because I have emceed so many weddings or spoken at so many weddings, weddings for me have always been about the other people. And so I am not very good at receiving like compliments or whatever. So like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to unpack it.
Yeah.
And what a wedding day is people speaking at you about you
in
a good way.
Yeah.
But it's like, I didn't know how to like process. So I just wept. Yeah.
And did you guys each do a speech?
Yeah. We each did a speech.
That's cool.
Our speeches were fucked up as well.
Yeah.
Like,
what do you mean?
Like at the reception, everyone was just in crying.
Okay.
Like
all
how many people? 200? Like
100? No, 100 people. Yeah.
Like everyone just crying. I was just like, I've cried nonstop for the whole day.
I've got no more tears to give.
No, it's insane.
Congratulations.
It was beautiful,
thank
man.
You.
It's awesome.
Thank
so beautiful.
I'm so glad.
And also like the best dance playlist I've ever seen on a dance floor.
I would fucking hope so.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would not want to attend your wedding.
You
and
know
not
there
eat.
Was Britney Spears.
And like,
you know there was
absolutely.
Backstreet Boys.
It was
you
like, know. It was also arranged so that you had like, the three Britney Spears songs, the three Celine Dion songs, the Cher songs.
Oh, interesting.
And then moving on to all the boy bands and the Spice Girls. And then Britney.
You know, if there's one thing you...
This is your own version of your own magic box.
Yeah, yeah. Curated.
Yeah, absolutely curated. Brilliant.
Oh, that's lovely.
And also all dance bangers.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
People were exhausted the next day. That's what we wanted.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Weirdly, four people got pregnant at our wedding. And I don't know how they had stamina after like... dancing to all of that. I was like, we were trying to prevent this from happening.
You know that four people conceived the
night.
Oh wait, you're not being sarcastic.
I'm not being sarcastic.
Oh, I thought that was a joke. Sorry.
No.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And I said to them, if I made a godparent, it's enough. We draw the line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's insane.
Listen, congrats with everything. I'm so happy that you've got this show that's been so perfectly made for you. you've still got 3 weeks, 2 weeks to go.
Yeah.
And then off to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
Something that I haven't said, and I think it's actually quite cool for you guys and for listeners of this podcast, is Disney's so particular about characters, and like you're not allowed to meet, you know, the way that people in the parks have to interact and whatever.
Well, there's tunnels underneath Disney World so that certain characters can get to other parts without sort of being in the wrong world.
Yes. And you know, like you hear these urban legends and you're like, it surely is not that way. Let me tell you, one of the coolest things I've ever experienced, which is in the beginning I was like, this is a cringe, but now I'm like, that actually was such a clever decision, was when we started the rehearsal process with Magic Box, we were taken separately. So each of us had played a character into a separate room where we were spoken to by Felipe and Anne. Anne is like a legend. She is basically the queen of Disney characters. Like, she is the person that's there to make sure that whatever you do with a character, it falls within the ambit of who the character is.
Sure. And it's a big responsibility, which is amazing.
She is so iconic, and her knowledge is amazing. And they gave me this whole speech about like who Mickey is and whatever, and then you meet your puppet, and only you and the puppet handler who puts you in the puppet are allowed to see the puppet disengaged. No one else. And for the first week of rehearsals,
even anyone in the cast,
no one else in the cast. And for the first week of rehearsals, the ensemble never met us. We were kept in a mirror studio where they didn't teach us how to puppeteer. Every puppeteer has to learn how to do their own puppet because they want your version of the puppet so that it feels distinct.
Wow.
And then we were introduced to the ensemble with the puppet on for the first time. And
that must have been awesome for the ensemble.
They literally burst into tears. Like, it was so... And then I was like, this is why they do this. This is why those rules exist, because it's actually so important to believing in the magic.
Right.
And yeah, be part of that is very, very cool.
They understand magic so well.
Totally.
And you realize that quite quickly when you go to a Disneyland or a Disney World, it's not thrill. One or two of the rides are thrill. The rest is all about magic. It's the speaker in the flower box where you don't really see or know where it is. You just feel magical.
Yeah.
Right.
Even when you have, very interestingly enough, run out of money, which very much happens when you're in Disney World, they have a script, a specific set of things to say. They don't say, oh, sorry, it says insufficient funds. They say, you've run out of magic.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
That's how they tell you, like,
that's how I feel on a triple show Saturday. I've run out of magic.
You told me there was a cool story about, was it a gift that Thaddeus gave you?
Oh, yeah, this is insane. So on opening night in Cape Town, Thaddeus, who's the director, obviously, like I said, we had this very cool relationship where we both spoke a lot about Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse, and Charlie Chaplin, who my human counterpart character is based off, you know, when as the puppeteer, because Mickey's based off Charlie Chaplin as a character, I thought, well, I'll base my physical performance off Charlie Chaplin. Mm. And so there was a lot of discussion about these three men and whatever. And on opening night, I went back to my dressing room, which I don't normally do, to get something just before I went onto stage. And I walked in and Thaddeus was in my dressing room and he was putting something down. And then he burst into tears and then he ran out. And
oh,
I was
shame.
Like, I've been fired. And like, I always just assume the worst.
It's a bomb.
Yeah. And I like opened up this package and inside was Thaddeus somehow bid on eBay for one of Walt Disney's ties.
What?
And it's got an embroidered Mickey Mouse on it.
No way.
And gave it to me as a gift. Like, it's insane.
Oh, what?
Yeah. And that they keep asking me why I haven't worn it to any of the opening nights. And I'm like, I'm never wearing
it. Yeah,
that.
You can't wear it.
Like, I'm framing that. That is worth more than my life. Like, it's insane.
That is incredible. Insane. What a special way to commemorate and pull all the different layers of meaning that this play is into single object.
Into one object.
That
it's
is
crazy.
Stunning.
It also sounds like a lovely relationship to maintain.
Totally.
I mean, you want to keep that relationship dear with Thaddeus.
What is really annoying, though, is he likes my husband Daniel more than me because he found out that Daniel's into birds and he's into birds as well.
I know.
So guess who went birding? And guess who's been invited to Barcelona where he lives to go birding? I was like, hi, can I come with?
It's like, no, you're doing my show.
Yeah. You are working for me, but Daniel's free to come over whenever.
We need to actually have Dan on the show to talk about birds. Like, seriously, it's the best conversation.
And docu-series.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like the best conversation ever. Every time I'm like, shut up, Brett.
Well,
I'm
here we go. Talk to you. Here's a reason to have Daniel. Daniel and I are, as of January, we commence shooting. We are creating the official BirdLife South Africa docu-series. So it's basically going to be for Netflix that we are doing this massive, big budget docu-series about birders. And Dan is going to be the host, obviously. So it's going to be really, really cool.
This is so exciting.
I am shitting myself because I'm basically having to direct like a 10-hour movie, essentially.
Yes. It's like a series format.
How are you going to do this while puppeteering in the rest of the world?
Russell, because I'm insane.
Okay.
Yeah, Brett, you've always... Brett, people talk about like multi-hyphenates and how it's like great. Brett is like, you triple majored at Rhodes
in law, music, I was about to say, and journalism.
You have had a history of being a lawyer.
Law, music, and journalism.
Do you still keep that practice going?
I do. I do a lot of stuff with like family law. I work a lot with kids, like getting kids out of very bad situations, like either getting them adopted or getting them into like... I've just done a case now where we managed to get this kid that was in such an abusive family to immigrate to Portugal to her grandfather. And it was one of the most rewarding things in the whole world. Like, I cannot tell you.
Wow,
it's amazing.
Dude.
But it is very heavy, obviously, like, because you have to read through terrible, like, medical reports and whatever. But that's why you go and play Mickey Mouse at night and touch chiffon to bring it back.
Are you able to do both?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Well, I mean...
Jeepers, dude.
I don't think it's for everyone, but I try and juggle as much as possible. Like,
wow.
I think especially with law, I think if you've got a degree where you can help disempowered people, you would be quite selfish to not use it in the right way.
Mm. Well, especially if you've got these other things in your life that could also bring time and money, you can then only take on the law stuff that you want to do, right?
Totally. Yeah.
You don't have to take everything.
No, luckily. And I've been very privileged in that way, in that my theater career has been very fruitful and full and busy and like... For a lot of people, especially people that create their own projects, that doesn't happen.
Mm-mm.
But from my first production, it just took off, and I've just been very grateful. But it's because I get to work with very talented people. Sure. Not Cole, but everyone else I've worked with.
But it's also like your stars have aligned, right? And to say it in a very cliche way and a trite way, it's kind of just like you're in the place you're meant to be in. So not that it's easy to be there, but it's just like... You're there, and that's why life is rewarding you for being there, right? Yeah.
I would hope that this is a reward. If it's a lesson that I'm going to learn, I don't want to know what's waiting at the end of this. I'm going to be very strong after carrying around 70 kilograms times a week. I'm going to enter the Olympics, so that's my next challenge.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've seen Naruto. My God, I just like segued into the nerdiest thing ever. But there's a kung fu character who has weights on his leg, and he's like famously very fast.
Yeah,
and then he's kind of losing this fight against someone that controls sand and wants to imprison you in a sand tomb, which is pretty hectic.
Okay.
But then he takes the weights off his leg, and then all of a sudden he's like moving at this blinding speed and you can't see him, and that's going to be Brett at the Olympics. You take off the 70-kilogram puppet.
I start the race with Mickey Mouse. And then just as you think I'm not going to win, I unclip that harness and there
and
I
then,
go.
And then there goes Usain Bolt.
But then I run so fast that I don't stop and I can't stop.
Like Forrest.
And I'm carrying the Olympic flame for the next 4 years.
It's why the Kenyans and the dudes and that are the marathon runners are so
because
good.
They do magic box.
Because they do magic.
Yeah, famously.
You can imagine those guys getting down to the coast and being like, oh my God, I can breathe so much better.
And famously, Usain Bolt played Goofy in the magic box. So like,
yes, exactly. So it all just
aligns. We're
tying
this whole thing together. Okay, we found you Palm Springs to Rent.
Can't wait.
It's a lovely, very easy watch. It's not going to shift the dial of cinema. But
it's on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime. It was on Showmax, I think, for a little. But yeah, it's out there. Listen, I don't think you have time to even rent something and watch something. You're doing too much.
Well,
but
we'll see.
And wasn't there a nice Owen Wilson movie about birding? Have you seen
that one? The Big Year.
The Big Year?
Totally. Yeah.
Seen it?
I have seen well, obviously I've seen it because I don't know if you know who I'm married to, but yes.
So then you've definitely seen that. Okay, so we're not going to rent you that. We'll just give you Palm Springs. But Brett, thank you for your time, man.
You guys, thank you so much for having me again. I thought the first time was the last time.
Never.
I'm very surprised that I'm back again. And
I'll be back again. We're so proud of you. And it's I think it's just lovely to talk about the process And I think it's exciting to sort of hear behind the scenes. Because as you said, you could watch the show and think it's a light, you know, easy to move puppet. But it's all so part much of the more illusion.
Yeah.
So it's nice to break it down. So thanks, man. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
And good luck with the rest of the shows.
Thank you.
And we'll see you soon.
All right. Bye.
All right, what a lekker chat. What a great dude. He always...
yeah, he's a good oak.
He brings a great spirit wherever he goes. Yeah, and I just think, once again, it's just so exciting that someone like him gets to be a part of creating this thing and actually like building it. I think you very rarely get that opportunity, and so that's quite exciting. All right, thank you for sticking around. I'm here with old Perrin. He's come back from doing the display. Are you covered in like white paint from doing the...
Yeah, no, the fake
making
snow.
Our African Christmas look snowy.
Yeah, covered in the fake snow that is definitely poisonous.
Yeah, apparently in Wizard of Oz, the 1939, the fake snow was like riddled with asbestos.
Yeah, didn't like most of Munchkin Town like die from that?
From like...
Like poison.
Poison related to asbestos.
That whole production is like proper cursed, eh? Yeah. Like crazy.
All right, let's do this.
Okay.
It's Christmas time. Let's go through Perrin's list of Christmas hidden gems.
Yes. Okay, so there's one or two that aren't really available here, but they're available to purchase physically via Blu-ray, DVD, whatever.
Okay.
So I'm going to recommend those as well, but I'm first going to recommend the stuff that you in South Africa can rent or stream right now.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, that's helpful.
So, big one, obviously, I mean, you've got to be living under a cinematic rock if you didn't know about this one, but The Holdovers is on Showmax.
Yes, and that's a nice new one.
It's a nice new one, so that's why I'm including it, because it's such a great little...
It is a Christmas movie.
It's such a great Christmas movie. You know, you've got these three unlikely friends just coming together over the Christmas holidays, and it's about a student who is forced to stay at his prep school over the Christmas holidays.
Everyone else goes away.
Everyone else goes away, and he's stuck with grumpy Paul Giamatti and...
Chef.
Yes, and the chef. Divine.
Divine. And she won an Oscar.
Yes, she won an Oscar.
So this was an Oscar darling in 2024. The Oscars that were at the start of 2024.
It's Alexander Payne.
Payne, who's a very talented filmmaker who did Sideways.
Divine Joy Randolph. She's phenomenal in it.
Fun fact, the guy who played the student, the main student, that was his first film.
Incredible performance. He's actually playing Anthony Bourdain in an upcoming biopic.
Yeah, he spoke about it. They went to the school to cast what would have been just the normal extras. They wanted it to be as authentic as possible, and they found him in the mix, and they were like, this could be our lead.
It's my favorite Alexander Payne film since... Probably Election. I mean, I loved Sideways, but this one is just so special.
I cannot drink Merlot.
without
the line at least being in my head. Most of the time, I say it out loud.
Yeah, whenever someone orders Merlot, because I don't drink, but whenever someone orders Merlot, I'm like, I'm not drinking fucking Merlot.
I'm not going to drink the fucking Merlot. Yeah.
Do you know what's crazy? Sorry, I'm diverting, but the Sideways, after that movie, Merlot sales dropped significantly.
Yeah, no, it's a term in economics called the sideways effect.
It's so wild. Anyways, okay.
There's nothing wrong with Milo.
Yeah, there really is.
There's nothing wrong with it.
He's just a snob.
He's just an asshole. Yeah. Okay, next one.
All right, so the obvious choice, everyone's like, oh, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Yes, it is, right?
Of course it is. Yeah.
But I'm going to throw out, the first Die Hard is probably my favorite Christmas movie, but Die Hard 2.
Die Harder.
Yes, is a... Such an underrated film in the Die Hard canon, and it's also a Christmas movie, which is more Christmassy, because obviously Die Hard 1 takes place in LA, so there's no snow. Die Hard 2 takes place at an airport, I think in New Jersey, and terrorists arrive, and it's Die Hard in an airport, and it fucking rules, and it's so good.
Okay.
One of my favorite moments of censorship ever. So obviously in America, on planes and stuff, I think they still do it. They censor bad language or sex or whatever. Right?
Yeah.
with Die Hard 2, my favorite instance of altering
the dialogue
was so you know his dialogue is yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Yeah.
This he says yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon, and everyone's like, who the fuck is Mr. Falcon?
Mr. Falcon.
Yeah, that's what they changed it to. There's no character named Mr. Falcon.
It just could be Mother Ucka or something.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my god, so good. But anyways, okay. Great little Christmas movie. Well, little Christmas movie, but it's underrated compared to Die Hard 1, which is great.
Cool. No, I like that.
Another one. Oh, okay. Some people I've spoken to didn't like this movie, but I think it's a great spin on Home Alone. It's called Better Watch Out.
Okay.
It's a home invasion, like, horror comedy movie. And basically, a babysitter is looking after these two kids, and they are, like, home invaders that arrive, and she has to, like, defend them from these people.
Okay.
And
Better Watch Out.
It's really, really fun. It's really, like, messed up as well.
Okay.
And there's some great twists that I obviously left out in my summary of what it's about, but it's so much fun.
Who's
really
in it?
Great watch. It's non-named actors, yeah. You won't recognize. They're like kids.
Okay. And where is
Apple
it available?
Apple TV, you can rent it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Die Hard 2, you can rent it as well.
Hmm.
Next one, Tokyo Godfathers, anime film by Satoshi Kon.
Yes, we in the past at the Bioscope have screened that as a dumpling box.
It's a great little movie.
Most of the time in December.
Yeah, it's a great little movie. So he obviously, if you're not too familiar with his name, he did classic anime films like Perfect Blue, Paprika. He did a great little show called
Millennium Actress.
Yes, Millennium Actress. He did a great little TV series called Paranoia Agent as well. But yeah, Tokyo Godfathers, really, really sweet Christmas movie about, like, the holdovers, three unlikely people who band together. One is a trans, they all homeless people, so one is a trans, like, drag queen person, one is a homeless old man, and one is a young girl who is a runaway,
and they have to look after a baby.
Yeah, they find a baby in the trash, and their whole goal, the whole movie, is to try get this baby back to its parents.
So Japanese animation.
Yeah, so good.
As we're saying,
I recommend watching it, obviously, in the Japanese audio because it's set in Japan.
Sure.
I find my rule of thumb is if it's set in a specific country, I prefer to watch it in that language.
Of course.
It's like a weird thing that I do.
We learned, you'll find this interesting with the Bioscope, we learned from day one, it's sub, not dub.
Yeah.
Literally, it was unanimous. At the moment we did it for the first time, you know, 13, 14 years ago. We said, which version do you guys want? It was painfully clear.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's some instances where the English dub is very good. Studio Ghibli, most of their dubs are phenomenal.
No, and they got famous actors in
Cowboy Bebop. I personally prefer that dub, over the English dub, over the Japanese dub, personally.
Interesting.
Because, it's just so well done. But anyways, that's on Apple TV. It's a great, sweet Christmas movie.
Tokyo Godfathers.
Yeah, it's not as dark or as, like, weird as Satoshi Kon's other works. So it's like a nice, like, it's just a nice, like, contrast to his other work. You know, it's this heartwarming Christmas movie. It's really, really good. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes, Shane I wanted Black. That to be on the list.
It's such a great, like modern noir film. Robert Downey Jr. is so funny in it. Val Kilmer is so funny in it.
And
essentially the whole plot is that Robert Downey Jr., the movie starts with him robbing a toy store to try to find toys for his kids. But then he gets chased by the cops and he accidentally runs into a casting audition. And they tell him that his partner died, but he didn't. And he's like, oh my God, he's dead. And he, like, thinks it's real. And this accidental reaction to a real moment lands him a potentially a job to be in a crime show or something in LA.
Yeah.
So he's quickly whisked away to LA. But then, and he meets a private eye, and Val Kilmer plays this private eye. He's like the consultant on this TV show. But while he's there, Robert Downey Jr. comes across, there's a dead body in his hotel room. And eventually it becomes one of those classic LA noir You know, web of deceit and lies and mystery.
But it's very
and stuff.
Funny. It's so very cool. Funny. And this is Robert Downey Jr. at the start of his comeback.
Comeback, yeah, 100%.
So this is pre Iron Man.
Yes,
but it's post Dwellums.
Yeah, and this is Shane. This is before Val Kilmer's throat cancer. It was throat cancer. Yeah, yeah. His throat cancer diagnosis. So it's
like a sort of a little bit of a chubby Val Kilmer.
Yeah,
being like. Kind of subtly gay as well.
Yeah, he's a gay private eye.
Yeah, it's like he's got, so he's funny. Got, what does he call the gun?
I'm not gonna say the word, but it's really funny. Shane Black, obviously, he was the writer on Lethal Weapon films. He did The Lost Boy Scout as well as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, I mean, he did Iron Man 3, but his most recent really great fun movie, also buddy cop movie, The Nice Guys. With Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. So good. But yeah, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
And it's really wonderful. Witty.
It's so witty.
Yeah, it's nice. I like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. So at this, in the era of DVDs, me at varsity going into my like career, I thought it would be nice to start building a library of DVDs because I couldn't see the end of DVDs. Do you know what I mean? Like in my head, this is like a collection that you buy.
Yeah.
And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was in my collection DVDs that I bought myself. Yeah.
No, it's a great, such a fun movie. And it's weirdly overlooked now as well. Like people don't really talk about it anymore. Yeah. And it was such a fun, interesting movie at the time.
Yeah.
Okay,
next one.
So that is on Apple TV as well. But now this next one, if you have a VPN, it's available on Hulu. But I recommend getting the Second Sight Blu-ray set from the UK. They're the best boutique label, in my opinion. But anyways, I'm adding this on the list because it's in preparation for Sean Baker's Anora.
Yes.
It's Tangerine.
Okay.
Have you seen Tangerine?
I haven't seen Tangerine.
So Tangerine was shot in an iPhone 5S. Okay. It takes place on Christmas Eve, and it follows trans prostitute sex workers. And the whole plot revolves around one of the protagonists. She'd just come out of jail, and she meets up with a friend who tells her that her boyfriend is cheating on her. So the whole movie is her trying to find this woman who he's cheated on and her boyfriend.
Okay.
And it's a great, like... isolated one day movie event, you know what I mean? Like it all takes place over the course of a few hours on Christmas Eve, and it's so good.
I'm assuming this is a Sean Baker film.
Yeah, it's Sean Baker. Okay. This was his breakthrough essentially. Okay. It was shot in iPhone 5S back in 2011 or 2010, I think. So it's got a very interesting visual style, but it's so funny, it's so frantic, it's just a great movie because Sean Baker loves to. I mean, he's done 5 films about sex workers.
Yeah, and of course, Anora is the latest one. And for those who don't know, Anora won the Palme d'Or, d'Or at Cannes, which is the big prize, the biggest prize.
Yeah,
it's a front runner in many Oscar categories this year.
I've seen it, so it's
incredible. And it's coming to the bioscope at the end of Jan.
Yes, it's definitely worth price of admission. Mikey Madison's phenomenal in that film, but like it's great. Tangerine's a great starting point to see. It's not Sean Baker's first film about sex workers. Starlet was before that, but Tangerine is such a fun, interesting perspective on, because Sean Baker, I like to consider him as the modern, he's the American neorealist at the moment. He likes to focus on characters who are on the outskirts, you know, these outsiders and stuff. And what he does is he doesn't judge his characters.
Yeah.
He just observes.
Yeah.
And then there's great key moments in all his films that puts into perspective of who they are and what they are about. And that could change your idea of what everything you've just seen is about. Like Red Rocket in particular, there's a great moment in that film where your perspective of this guy changes entirely. Mm. Like you hate him the whole way through, but you love to hate him.
Mm.
And you hate that you love him as well because he's like very charming and...
But yeah. what is your definition of neorealism? The fact that you let these people be authentic, real characters, you try and capture reality as much as possible.
So neorealism to me is you following the everyman. You're following the people that are generally like with neorealism, you don't usually have actors playing the characters. You know what I mean? It's usually non-actors or, yeah. And I mean, obviously some of these films like Red Rocket, Simon Rex is an actual actor. So,
but it's presented in a style where it feels like you're the fly on the wall.
Yeah, they're not
these stylized. Yes. It never feels scripted. Yeah. Of course it always is. But
yeah.
But it just... It's trying to capture a reality in a moment as opposed to create it.
Tangerine, in my opinion, at least, I mean, look, it doesn't adhere to like the classic Italian neorealism styles and stuff like that. But like with Sean Baker's style, he's developed such an interesting visual language and also narrative language for his characters and his worlds. You know what I mean? And Tangerine is the prime example of that. So it's a Christmas movie because it takes place on Christmas.
Yeah, cool.
And it's really... It's a great, like, bottle movie where it's just all these events take place in the space of a few hours, almost in real time. And
they probably banged that out in many ways over a few days.
Yeah, I think Tangerine was shot in, a few days. And, like, Sean Baker, if you want to... He's a great, like, proper independent filmmaker.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Anora is obviously his biggest work, and it's... I'd say it's his most commercially viable work, but then it gets to the point in that film where everything just changes and it's like he flips the conventions on his head once again, because that's what I love about him is he loves to flip conventions of the genre on its head, you know what I mean?
No, I'm excited for Anora.
It's so great. Like, I'm excited to see it on a big screen with a room full of people.
Yeah, because I think it's going to have a lot of... gasps, and it's very funny, apparently.
It's hysterical.
It's very funny.
It's very funny.
No, that's important to know.
Yeah.
Okay, P-Dog.
Thanks, man.
Appreciate you, man. Thank you for a great list.
Yeah, thanks.
And, guys, I hope you safe over Christmas and New Year.
Yeah.
Hope you find your joy, your version of family, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And, just be safe out there, man.
Yeah, be safe, guys. Hey? Enjoy.
Cool. So the home base is thevideostore.co.za. If you don't know, there are links to previous guests as well. Mm-hmm. In the previous chat with Brett is there. And, we'll kick off again in the new year. The plan, once again, is to do our most rented episode. We do that to kind of bookend the year. So. Yeah. This year, instead of doing it at the end, we're going to do it at the start because we still want a few more weeks or a couple more days to watch more content.
Yeah.
And then when we'll start the new year with our best of the previous year.
Okay. Yeah. I'm excited.
So that's the plan. That episode will come out around the 7th of Jan.
Amazing.
Okay. Magic.
Cool. Good job.
Cheers, buddy.
Enjoy.
Bye.